Still, the bones of Star Wars were falling into place. The droids are looking for their old master. Luke hires Han and Chewie. There's a rescue mission, a fall into a garbage chute, and an assault on the Death Star. But there are still too many locations, too many names, too many planets, and, one of Lucas's biggest problems, too much backstory and too many long speeches. Ladd was confused by it. It wasn't much like the rough draft he'd seen in May 1974, and Coppola, too, made it clear that he thought it was a mess, wondering aloud why Lucas was dumping all the elements that he had liked in the first draft. Worse, even with Macquarie's paintings providing a better feel for the look of things, the new script did little to help Fox executives decide on a final budget. With Fox stalling, Lucas asked Kurtz to put together a budget that they could bring to Ladd, essentially telling the studio what the budget should be. That was fine with Kurtz, who had wanted for months to get started on production. Privately, Lucas and Kurtz thought they could probably make the movie for less than $4 million, with Kurtz spitballing costs at $2.5 million and Lucas, who was convinced he could make a science fiction film in the handheld documentary style he loved, estimating a budget of $3.5 million. At Fox, however, the response was one of continued bewilderment. One Fox budget analyst estimated that special effects alone would drive costs over $6 million. Kurtz threw up his hands. I came up with a $15 million and a $6 million and a $10 million budget, said Kurtz. And it was totally arbitrary. You have to design the sets before you know how much things are going to cost. Shrugging off the indecisive Fox, Lucas and Kurtz were determined to move forward as if they had a deal in place, continuing to pour their own American Graffiti profits into developing Lucas's Flash Gordon thing. In April, Kurtz began looking for studio space. Even without formal set designs, Kurtz estimated they would need 11 sound stages, including a gigantic one for the final award ceremony Lucas was still determined to keep in his story. Soundstages at Columbia and Warner Brothers were too small, so Kurtz headed for London, where one of the largest facilities was at Pinewood, home to several James Bond films. But officials at Pinewood required filmmakers to use Pinewood staff, a concession Lucas, ever the control freak, wasn't willing to make. Finally, Kurtz took a look at Elstree Studios, a run-down facility just north of London, all but abandoned since completion of Murder on the Orient Express in 1974. Elstree had plenty of space, and, even better, Lucas could bring his own crew to handle everything from cinematography to catering. Kurtz booked Elstree for a 17-week period, to begin in March 1976, a little less than a year away. But even Kurtz, who prided himself on lowballing his budgets, could see that this wasn't going to be a film that could be made on the cheap. He guessed it would cost around $13 million. Lucas grimaced. That was way beyond what he initially thought it might cost. And at that point, $13 million sounded too high. An even $10 million sounded more reasonable. That would be the number he submitted to Fox as the proposed budget. Fox promised to get back to him. Lucas would have to keep waiting, but he was growing more angry and impatient by the day. Necessity would force Lucas to make perhaps the investment that would become the cornerstone of his self-made empire. From day one, Lucas had wanted his film to feature a dramatic dogfight in outer space, with spaceships tumbling and spiraling in a manner similar to real warplanes. But visuals like that were going to require some exceptional special effects, and Fox, like every other major studio, no longer produced special effects in-house. In the past, studios had used visual effects primarily to keep costs down, producing miniatures, models, and matte paintings to make back lots look larger or to recreate exotic locations. But films like Easy Rider and The Rain People had changed the Hollywood production mentality. Why create an alternate reality on a back lot when you could simply film on location? Effects shops were shuttered, effects men, and they were almost entirely men, retired. With no real special effects shops to utilize then, Lucas decided he had no choice but to create his own. He just needed the right person to run it, someone creative and aggressive who shared his vision for the film but wasn't too visionary, since Lucas still intended to control things as much as he could. Speed mattered too. Lucas would need his manager not only to set up shop as quickly as possible, but also to begin producing effects almost immediately. First, Lucas approached Jim Danforth, a stop-motion animator best known for his work on the 1970 film When Dinosaurs Ruled the Earth. But Lucas rubbed the animator the wrong way, and Danforth was unsettled by the seat-of-the-pants nature of the project. "I liked the idea of the film, sci-fi with a sense of fun, but just didn't want the problems of working with Lucas," said Danforth. "He was right out front with me, told me, 'I don't know how we're going to do all this stuff. Maybe we'll darken a studio and throw models at a camera. But whatever we do, I'll be right there with you. I can't work like that.' So I turned it down." Next, Lucas turned to veteran Douglas Trumbull, who'd overseen special effects for 2001 A Space Odyssey, Silent Running, and The Andromeda Strain. Trumbull, too, said no, most likely to accept a better offer from Steven Spielberg to produce special effects for Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which, unlike Lucas's movie, actually had a budget and a shooting schedule. Privately, Lucas was likely relieved, as he had quickly come to realize that handing the project to Trumbull would mean losing control altogether. "If you hire Trumbull to do your special effects, he does your special effects. I was very nervous about that," Lucas said later. "I wanted to be able to say, it must look like this, not that. I don't want to be handed an effect at the end of 5 months and be told, 'Here's your special effect, sir.' I want to be able to have more say about what's going on. It's really become binary. Either you do it yourself, or you don't get any say." So Lucas didn't get Trumbull either. But Trumbull did recommend one of his assistants from Silent Running, an opinionated and fiercely independent young man named John Dykstra. What the 27-year-old Dykstra didn't have in years of on-the-job experience, he more than made up for with brilliance, enthusiasm, and a belief that no project was impossible. Lucas and Kurtz went to interview Dykstra together in a bungalow on the Universal lot and were immediately impressed. Lucas explained the plot of the newest draft of the Star Wars to Dykstra as best he could, which involved a lot of hand-flying, Dykstra recalled later, and showed the reel of dogfights he had edited together from old war movies. Dykstra was immediately intrigued. George's initial concept was that he wanted something very quick and dirty, said Dykstra. He wanted something we could grind out quickly and cheaply. Still, as the two of them watched the dogfight reel and talked through some of the visual effects, Lucas was adamant that he didn't want men in black suits with models on sticks. He was already spending money on Colin Cantwell and Ralph McQuarrie to design and build realistic-looking spaceships. He didn't want that illusion broken the moment the ships took flight. "We're going to have to make something more sophisticated," Lucas told Dykstra. That was fine with Dykstra, who thought he knew just what Lucas needed. Several years earlier, Dykstra had worked with motion control technology at the Institute of Urban and Regional Development at Berkeley, where, as part of a planning project, he had programmed a PDP-11 computer to guide a small 16mm camera through a model city. Unlike stop-action effects, which require the shutter of the camera to be open and closed every time a model is moved a fraction of an inch, motion control is all about moving the camera, not the model. Motion control, then, would give Lucas exactly what he needed, allowing the camera, with computer-programmed precision, to do the diving and swooping needed for his space battle. What Lucas really wanted, recalled Dykstra, was fluidity of motion, the ability to move the camera around so that you could create the illusion of actually photographing spaceships from a camera platform in space. It was almost like documentary-style special effects, with the camera as an observer. No wonder Lucas loved it. There was only one real problem. The camera needed to film a project on the scale of the Star Wars, with multiple models requiring multiple passes by the camera, didn't yet exist. Dykstra was anxious to actually build one, said Lucas, because it was an idea that John had had for quite a while, and this seemed like the perfect opportunity to exploit that. But the clock was ticking. Lucas wanted to work on effects to start as quickly as possible, and ideally be finished by late 1976 or early 1977, so he could edit them into the live-action sequences. In that time, Dykstra would not merely have to produce the visual effects, he would have to develop the technology needed to shoot them in the first place. At that point, recalled Dykstra, I said, this is going to be hard to do in a year, George. And he said, I don't care, kid, just do it. So, we did it. It wasn't quite as simple as that, however. First, Lucas had to find a building to house his special effects shop. Lucas wanted his facility close to home, preferably near Park House in Marin County. But Dykstra persuaded him to stay close to Hollywood, where they would have ready access to film development and processing. Kurtz, who always seemed to know how to scout for locations, found an unassuming and newly constructed warehouse at 6842 Valjean Avenue in Los Angeles, across from the Van Nuys Airport. The building was essentially a sweltering cavern, probably 1,300 square feet, and it smelled like a gym locker, as Dykstra put it, with no interior walls, no offices, no equipment, not even air conditioning. Lucas thought it was perfect. Jim Nelson, a post-production ace and old friend of Kurtz's from Tulane Blacktop, was put in charge of banging the warehouse into shape and spent 6 hot weeks outfitting 3 major departments, model building, camera work, and optical compositing, where all the shots would eventually be combined. As far as hiring staff, we approached the visual effects as a grand experiment, said Kurtz, asking ourselves, can we do this with a lot of people who work on architectural models and commercials and had never made feature films before? Finding employees would never be a problem. Every model maker, artist, and film geek who loved science fiction, especially those who had seen THX 1138, wanted to work for Lucas. Cinematographer Richard Edlund and effects artist Dennis Murin had made only short films, a few commercials, and some TV work. Storyboard artist Joe Johnston and animator Peter Curran were both still in college, and Curran wanted the job so badly he offered to work for free. It was a lot of young kids, basically, said Lucas. Very few of them had worked on a feature film. Nelson, while technically in charge, was really just one of the inmates running the asylum, and he and Dykstra openly encouraged an atmosphere of goofball collegiality that sparked both inspiration and collaboration. I hired people who were young, people who had not really had a lot of industry experience, but were talented people, people that I'd worked with before, said Dykstra. And we formed a group that was cooperative. I can't stress that enough. Cooperative. It helped, too, that Lucas had actively discouraged hiring from the unions. They had always left a bad taste in his mouth anyway, and he had no patience with the rules they would have imposed on a production that had no time to get bogged down in process. Everybody sort of could cross-train and work in different techniques, as Dennis Murin put it. That was different than a Hollywood system that had very strict union rules. There was no way this work could be done that way, or no way that the Hollywood unions could understand what we were doing. Not that the unions didn't try. Later that fall, as Dykstra and his team were beginning to build their computerized motion-controlled camera, which everyone was already referring to as the Dykstra Flex, a name the wily Dykstra made no effort to change, union representatives stopped by to argue that Lucas should be hiring effects experts from inside the industry. Dykstra insisted that he had tried, but, quite frankly, I didn't find anybody that I wanted. Lucas chose to simply ignore the unions. George was absolutely adamant that we wanted to set up our own shop with our own people, explained lawyer Tom Pollock. That was one of the control things that we'd been fighting about from the beginning. At the moment, however, special effects were yet another expense in which a nervous Fox was unwilling to invest. Lucas had assured Ladd that he could do the effects work for a little more than $2 million, a number that, in reality, wouldn't even come close to his costs. But Fox had continued to waffle, insisting Lucas cut his effects budget down to $1.5 million. They just assumed that it would all get done somehow, sighed Lucas. They just figured that we could do it for $1.5 million and that it was our problem, not theirs. As Dykstra and his effects wizards went to work, Lucas continued to pour his American Graffiti money into the unassuming warehouse across from the Van Nuys Airport, spending nearly $88,000 in its first 3 weeks of its operation. Lucas claimed later that the name for his new special effects company had simply popped into his head as he was drafting the organization's articles of incorporation. We said, "What are we going to call this thing?" They were in an industrial park, Lucas explained. They were building these giant Dykstra Flex machines to photograph stuff, so that's where the light came from. In the end, I said, "Forget the industrial and the light. This is going to have to be magic. Otherwise, we're doomed, making a movie nobody wants." Industrial light and magic it would be then, an official subsidiary of Lucasfilm Limited. Born of necessity, seeded with his own money, and feeding off Lucas's need to control every aspect of production, ILM would stand as one of the cornerstones of Lucas's film empire, an investment that would set him well on the way to becoming a multi-billionaire. How many people think the solution to gaining quality control, improving fiscal responsibility, and stimulating technological innovation is to start their own special effects company? Ron Howard said admiringly. But that's what he did. On Friday, June 20th, 1975, Steven Spielberg's Jaws opened in 409 theaters and changed movies forever. As Lucas had predicted, Spielberg had a colossal hit on his hands, one that surprised even Spielberg, who had brought the film in over budget and 100 days late, and nearly had a nervous breakdown, all but convinced he'd just made a spectacular dud. But Jaws was more than just a great film. For the first time, a Hollywood studio, in this case Universal, had recognized that distribution and advertising mattered, especially advertising on television. Instead of opening in only a few theaters in select cities, Jaws opened in hundreds of theaters nationwide. And with nearly $2.5 million in marketing and promotion behind it, double the amount spent for most films, Jaws was an unavoidable presence in the summer of 1975. With terrifying primetime television spots, a memorable poster, and marketing that included board games and beach towels. Like the film's titular character, Jaws kept slowly trolling along all summer, drawing crowds week after week. Spielberg remembered reading the returns each weekend and waiting for the next weekend to drop off. And it didn't. It went up, and it went up. In its first release, Jaws would set a record of $129 million in rentals. Studios watched with envy as Universal counted its profits. But those profits had come at a cost. Advertising was expensive, as were the prints needed for a nationwide release, and studios wanted those costs recovered as quickly as possible. The way to recover those costs? More advertising and release to even more theaters. It was a snake, or in this case, a shark, devouring its own tail. The modern blockbuster was born. While Spielberg savored his success, Lucas was hunkered down again, working his way through revisions to his script. As he read through the most recent draft, Lucas realized he had no leading female characters. He had shuffled Leia off to secondary status too quickly, and therefore decided that Luke was now a girl. A decision that lasted only long enough for Macquarie to complete one painting with a female hero. By May, Luke was male again, and Lucas submitted to LAD a new, hastily written 6-page synopsis in which he'd added a new character, a mystical old man he had lifted straight out of the pages of Carlos Castaneda's 1968 The Teachings of Don Juan, A Yaqui Way of Knowledge. Castaneda, an anthropologist educated at UCLA, was in the midst of writing a series of books describing his own apprenticeship to the Yaqui shaman Don Juan Matus, and Lucas soaked up all the Castaneda he could as he struggled with themes of father-son and master-apprentice relationships in his script. Old Man can do magic, read minds, talk to things like Don Juan, Lucas wrote in his May 1975 treatment. By the time Lucas completed the next draft in August, the Old Man even had a name, General Ben Kenobi. In fact, by the third draft, completed in August 1975, Lucas had tightened and improved the script even further, moving Luke more firmly to the center of the script as the hero, and making Leia, instead of Deke, the character who gets captured and needs rescuing. Lucas still has the Kyber crystal in the script, but was beginning to realize that pursuing the stolen plans for the Death Star made for a much more interesting story. "I find plots boring," Lucas insisted, "because they're so mechanical." Mechanical or not, the plot we generally recognize as Star Wars is falling into place here. After more than 2 years of writing, of bleeding on the page, Lucas knew he was finally close to getting it right. Each story was a totally different story about totally different characters before I finally landed on the story, he said later with near palpable relief. And yet even his own progress depressed him. While Lucas saw Star Wars as his response to a weary world in need of new heroes and mythologies, his friend saw it as a juvenile exercise unworthy of his talent. Wasn't this the boy wonder whose experimental films and tone poems had dazzled intellectuals and amazed audiences? They said, "George, you should be making more of an artistic statement," Lucas grumbled. "People said I should have made Apocalypse Now after Graffiti. They said I should be doing movies like Taxi Driver." Marcia finally pulled aside one of Lucas's newer friends, the director Brian De Palma, who, like Lucas, had started in arty documentary-type films and was now trying for a more mainstream hit with an adaptation of Stephen King's 1974 novel, Carrie, and begged De Palma to cheer George up. "George thinks he has no talent," she told him flatly. "He respects you. Tell him he does." Lucas began casting in August. De Palma was at his side, for both personal and practical reasons. De Palma wanted to begin casting Carrie, and he and Lucas, who was casting the parts of Luke, Leia, and Han, needed actors roughly the same age bracket. Working out of the Zoetrope offices Coppola kept at the Goldwyn Studios in Los Angeles, Lucas and De Palma, along with Fred Roos, Lucas's shrewd casting director from American Graffiti, saw thousands of kids, with auditions starting at 8 or 9 in the morning and running until well after 8 in the evening. At that pace, most actors spent little more than a few minutes in front of the directors. "Brian did all the talking," remembered Carrie Fisher, "because George didn't talk then." Most of those who auditioned assumed Lucas was De Palma's assistant. Lucas may have been quiet, but he was taking casting seriously. He intended for there to be a love triangle involving the three main characters, an intergalactic Casablanca. So the chemistry among the three leads was critical. It mattered even more, in fact, in a film in which most of the cast were robots and aliens, or covered in full-body armor. As in any of the countless road movies of the 1940s, in which the interplay among Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, and Dorothy L'Amour could carry a film when the plot sagged, Lucas needed his leads to help ensure the audience suspended its disbelief and didn't get bogged down in details. There would be no ham acting or knowing winks at the camera. Star Wars might have been an affectionate nod to the old science fiction serials of the 1930s and 1940s, but it wasn't camp. His actors, then, had to play it straight. Looks mattered, too. For a director, your first impression of them is the same impression more or less as the audience's when they meet them, said Lucas. As Mark Hamill put it, they weren't going to just let us read. You had to look right first. Nearly every young actor in Hollywood and New York, it seemed, wanted to audition. John Travolta, Nick Nolte, and Tommy Lee Jones all came in during the first week. Lucas would immediately pass on all three, though De Palma would pick Travolta for a role in Carrie. 23-year-old Mark Hamill, who had a long resume of small television parts, showed up to audition only after some prodding from his friend Robert Englund, who had unsuccessfully tried out for the part of Han Solo. Despite missing out on the part of Han, Englund would take on another iconic role years later, playing Freddy Krueger in countless Nightmare on Elm Street films. As a lifelong science fiction and comic book nerd, Hamill loved the idea of being the hero in a sci-fi film, but had only barely sat down to introduce himself before Lucas waved him out of the room. Hamill, who had also unsuccessfully auditioned for American Graffiti, thought he had blown it again. Lucas seemed much more interested in Robbie Benson and Will Seltzer, both of whom he asked to come back. Casting for Leia was harder, at least to the mind of Marcia, who only half-jokingly teased her husband about auditioning every young actress on the West Coast. I knew he was going to be looking at the most beautiful 18- and 19-year-old girls in Hollywood for Princess Leia, and I felt so insecure, she recalled. I said, George, are you going to be a good boy when you're down there? Lucas grimaced. My first vow when I came to a film studio was never to date an actress, he said. Lucas saw himself as just a funny kid. And someone like a Playmate of the Month is coming after me? Life is too short for that. Marcia didn't have a thing to worry about. Lucas was essentially a brain in a jar, sitting stoically through casting sessions, and eventually passing on Amy Irving, another actress De Palma would nab, Jodie Foster, and Linda Pearl. While he was skeptical about casting any of his American Graffiti stars in his current project, he loyally sat through an audition with Cindy Williams before scratching her off the list of possibilities as well. Williams later heard that Lucas told others he was looking for a young Cindy Williams. I just about died, she sighed. Every actress waits in anticipated horror to hear those words. After several weeks of auditions, Lucas thought he'd found the perfect princess in a young actress named Terry Nunn, who'd only just turned 14 in June, though she looked much older, and in fact often added several years to her age when out on auditions. Finding the right Han Solo proved to be the trickiest task of all. Solo had evolved on the page more than most of the other characters, starting as a gilled green-skinned alien, progressing through a burly Coppola-like phase, and finally becoming a world-weary, somewhat cynical pirate, part James Dean, part Humphrey Bogart. It was a role that was going to take just the right amount of swagger and sincerity. Lucas had briefly considered casting an African-American, looking closely at 28-year-old actor Glenn Turman. But given that he was contemplating a romance between Han and Leia, Lucas was concerned that an interracial relationship might be too distracting for 1970s audiences. He didn't want Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, said Kurtz. Turman remained on Lucas's shortlist for Han, but after considering several other promising prospects, including Al Pacino and Kurt Russell, Lucas had all but settled on a quirky, slightly dangerous New Yorker, 32-year-old Christopher Walken. Lucas's core cast wouldn't finally come together until December, when he called back several groups of actors, mostly Luke's and Leia's, to sit for another 3 days of auditions. This time, there would be a camera rolling, so Lucas, as he had done with tryouts for American Graffiti, could see how his actors looked on camera. While Lucas thought he was close to finding his cast, casting director Fred Ruse had coyly salted Lucas's shortlist for Luke and Leia with some suggestions of his own. He had also cleverly planted another possibility for Han Solo right under Lucas's nose by hiring a carpenter to frame and hang a door in the Zoetrope offices, Harrison Ford. Ford had found acting jobs scarce since American Graffiti and had returned to carpentry to feed his young family. But Ruse liked Ford and thought he was worth a look. Getting George to consider Harrison took some working around, said Ruse. For one thing, Ford didn't even want to be in the room working on his knees as a carpenter when there was a casting call. It was too humiliating. I'm not working a fucking door while Lucas is there, he had groused to Ruse. But Ruse had a plan. As actors came in to audition for other roles, Ruse suggested to Lucas that Ford read Han's lines with them. Though still wary of hiring any of his cast from graffiti, Lucas was willing to let Ford play off the other actors, and after watching Ford for several days, Lucas was intrigued. "I thought, here's a possibility," said Lucas, "but I had to go through the whole process. I wasn't going to take anyone just because I knew them, or I knew they could act well. I really wanted to see all the diverse possibilities and come at it fresh." On December 30th, Ford would officially become one of those diverse possibilities when he read with two actors suggested by Ruse, one of whom Lucas had already auditioned and dismissed, and another he hadn't seen at all. Mark Hamill had left his August session with a confused shrug and had all but forgotten about Star Wars when his agent informed him he was going back to audition again, this time working off four pages from the latest draft of the script, heavy with Lucas's unique brand of techno-speak. "There's a line I remember from the original test," said Hamill, "where I say, 'We can't turn around. Fear is their greatest weapon. I doubt if the actual security there is any greater than it was on Aquilae or Sullust, and what there is most likely directed toward a large-scale assault.'" And I thought, who talks like this? But Hamill delivered the lines with just the right amount of excitement and naivete that Lucas was impressed. "Okay, good," he said, about the closest Lucas would ever come to support and enthusiasm. But Hamill was still convinced he'd lost the part. "I didn't feel bad or disappointed," said Hamill. "It was just a clean no-go." The other actor Lucas saw that day was Carrie Fisher, the 19-year-old daughter of Hollywood actors Debbie Reynolds and Eddie Fisher, who had made her big acting debut only a year earlier in a small but memorable role in Shampoo. Fisher had missed the auditions in August, but Ruse encouraged Lucas and Fisher to meet. Fisher received her pages of the script, and she too rolled her eyes, though for a different reason. "Leia was unconscious a lot," recalled Fisher. "I have an affinity for unconscious, but I also wanted to be involved in all of it." Fisher read with Ford, her Leia responding aggressively and at times with exasperation to Solo's badgering. Though Lucas found Fisher a bit pushy for a princess, if he was looking for chemistry, he'd found it between Fisher and Ford. Ford, too, was feeling better and better about his chances for the role he hadn't actively sought. In the course of a month, he'd rehearsed the same lines with enough actors that he knew the dialogue backward and forward and could deliver it in a relaxed, almost cocksure manner. It was undeniable that over 3 weeks, Ford had molded Han Solo into his own character. And while Lucas was still interested in Christopher Walken for the part, Ford was quickly becoming a contender. Even the Hikes were pushing for Ford, telling Lucas that Ford was more fun. But Ford, like Hamill and Fisher, left the auditions in a cloud of uncertainty. Lucas had narrowed his lead threesome down to two competing groups. In one was Walken, Will Seltzer, and Terry Nunn, a trio Lucas described as a little more serious, a little more realistic. In the other, Ford, Hamill, and Fisher, a group Lucas called a little more fun, more goofy. It would take until January for him to make up his mind. Lucas liked both threesomes, but one trio seemed to entail more problems than the other. Nunn was a minor, first of all, which would severely limit the number of hours she could work each day. And Seltzer, well, Lucas just felt he was a little too intellectual, whereas Hamill was idealistic, naive, and hopeful. Lucas would go with the trio of Hamill, Ford, and Fisher then, with only one condition. "I got the part with the proviso that I went to a fat farm," said Carrie Fisher dryly, "and that I lose 10 pounds. Lucas was happy with his cast. "I look for magic," he said later. "What can I say?" But not everyone was so sure he had made the right decision. "I disagreed with George's casting," said Coppola, "but it was not for me to say." Said Ladd, "I'd be lying if I said, 'My God, Harrison's perfect.' No, I was very nervous about the cast." Ladd was also nervous that Lucas hadn't yet hired a big-name actor for the film. For Lucas, Using unknown actors was important. He wanted audiences relating to the characters, not the actors. But he did have a name actor in mind for the role of Ben Kenobi, and asked casting director Diane Crittenden to arrange a meeting with the English actor Alec Guinness, who was in Los Angeles wrapping work on the film Murder by Death. Crittenden managed to have a copy of the latest version of the script delivered to Guinness's dressing room, along with a bundle of Macquarie's paintings. Guinness was annoyed from the start. He didn't like people pushing scripts on him, and he was particularly dubious about science fiction. But Guinness was preparing to produce a play in London, and he needed the money. Looking at Star Wars as nothing more than a paycheck, he agreed to have lunch with Lucas. Lunch went well enough. In his diary, Guinness described Lucas as a small, neat-faced young man with a black beard, with tiny, well-shaped hands, poorish teeth, glasses, and not much sense of humor. But I liked him. One colleague had told Guinness that Lucas was a real director, and after meeting him, Guinness was inclined to agree, though he admitted he found him a touch boring. But he wasn't ready to commit. There was going to have to be enough money involved for Guinness to overcome his doubts about the script. "I may accept if they come up with proper money," Guinness wrote in his diary. "Science fiction, which gives me pause, but it is to be directed by Paul Lucas," Guinness means George Lucas, "who did American Graffiti, which makes me feel I should. Big part. Fairy tale rubbish, but could be interesting, perhaps." He and Lucas would keep talking, and Ladd was pleased that Lucas was at least adding a recognizable name to his cast. "Guinness didn't sell tickets on his own," said Ladd, "but it was nice that he was in the picture." In addition to his cast, Lucas spent much of the summer of 1975 assembling other key creative personnel, all brilliant in their own ways, and each hand-picked by the control-craving Lucas. John Barry, a gifted set designer who had worked on A Clockwork Orange, had been a happy accident, discovered while Lucas was visiting the hikes in Mexico, where director Stanley Donen was filming their 1930s-era script, Lucky Lady. Lucas was stunned by how realistic the sets looked. As he stood in a set built to resemble an old salt factory, he even rolled up the sleeves of his plaid shirt to see if he could shovel the salt. To his delight, he could, and he called over Barry and set decorator Roger Christian to discuss having them design and decorate sets for Star Wars, telling them that he wanted it all looking real and used. Christian was ecstatic. "My first conversation with Lucas was that spaceships should be things you see in garages with oil dripping," said Christian, "and they keep repairing them to keep them going, because that's how the world is." Lucas nodded approvingly, but enthusiasm was only part of it. "Star Wars," he explained, "was a big project that was going to have to be made quickly." Lucas wanted to start filming in February 1976, only about 7 months away, "and cheaply. I think anybody with more experience would have just said, 'I don't think I can do it in that amount of time,'" said Barry. But he decided, "I have just enough experience to be able to cope with the problems, and just enough inexperience so I should take it on." Lucas hired them both, paying each with still more of his American Graffiti money. Barry and Christian would help Lucas ensure his movie looked great, but Lucas also wanted to make certain his movie sounded like nothing else before it. Sound had always been important to Lucas, whether it was orchestrating the eerie undercurrent of whirs and chatter he had embedded in THX 1138, or making sure American Graffiti had a rock score that complemented but didn't overwhelm the action on screen. When it came to sound, then, Lucas's go-to had always been Walter Murch, and Lucas had even ensured that his agreement memo with Fox specified that Murch would be in charge of sound. But that had been in 1973. By the summer of 1975, Murch was committed to several other projects and was unavailable for Star Wars. So Lucas went to USC and asked for the next Walter Murch, and was referred to a 27-year-old graduate student named Ben Burt, who, like Murch, had been sticking a microphone under pretty much everything since he was a kid. Burt's first assignment, courtesy of Gary Kurtz, find the voice for a Wookiee. Armed with a Nagra recorder and microphones borrowed from Zoetrope, Burt recorded zoo animals pored over sound collections at movie studios, and even rented animals, eventually crafting Chewbacca's distinctive roars, moans, and whimpers from a carefully mixed blend of sounds made by four bears, a lion, a seal, and a walrus trapped at the bottom of a dry pool at Marineland near Long Beach. Impressed, Lucas asked Burt to put together an entire library of sounds for the film. "Collect weird, strange sounds," Lucas told him, and Burt would loiter at airports, bang on guy wires, and record vibrating film projectors in the search for the best sounds for spacecraft, laser guns, and lightsabers. Burt thought assembling the sound library might involve a few weeks' work, but 29 years and 10 months later, I finally came to the end of building that library. What Burt would eventually give Lucas would define not just six Star Wars films, but science fiction sound effects for a generation of filmgoers. But if Lucas truly wanted to give Star Wars a unique personality in sound, he would find it in the savvy choice he made for the composer of his film music. Lucas knew he wanted a classical-sounding score, something swashbuckling and with a personality of its own, to enhance the images on screen. While visiting Spielberg on Martha's Vineyard in early spring, where Spielberg was in post-production on Jaws, Lucas mentioned he was on the lookout for a composer who could give him a very sort of Max Steiner-type old-fashioned romantic movie score. Spielberg immediately recommended John Williams, a 43-year-old Oscar nominee who had scored both Jaws and The Sugar Land Express. "I've worked with this guy and he's great," Spielberg told him. The introduction was made, and after reading Lucas's script, Williams agreed to compose the score for Star Wars, but not until the following year, as he was already at work on music for two thrillers, Alfred Hitchcock's Family Plot and John Frankenheimer's Black Sunday. It would be Williams, perhaps more than any other collaborator, who would give Star Wars the air of excitement and dignity that Lucas envisioned, and his score would become iconic. Its opening brass blare cheered by audiences through seven movies and counting. Lucas would always be open in his admiration for Williams. "He's right up there with Buddy Holly and the Drifters," Lucas would say later, the highest praise he could give any musician. As the summer wore on, Lucas was still slogging through rewrites on his script, still sitting down in front of the evening news with a scowl on his face. Marcia, however, was no longer there to make reassuring noises or beg friends to tell George he was brilliant. She had taken yet another job working for Martin Scorsese, this time as supervising editor for Taxi Driver. Their plans to start a family would remain once again on hold. Not that Lucas was going to be home much either. In late August 1975, he and Kurtz left for England to start pre-production at Elstree, looking over a land speeder John Barry was tinkering with, as well as a prototype of R2-D2, made of unpainted wood with a primer gray swivel head. Lucas picked up several more members of his cast in London as well. 6'7" Welshman and bodybuilder David Prowse was given his choice of either Darth Vader or Chewbacca, and chose the villain, leaving the role of the Wookiee to 7'2" Peter Mayhew, a genial hospital porter who was said to have a pair of the largest feet in London. For the role of C-3PO, Lucas had to cast a much wider and more specialized net. He wasn't necessarily interested in the way the actor sounded. He planned on dubbing in 3PO's voice later, ideally with the cadences of a Bronx used car dealer. But he needed an actor who could play a convincing robot, preferably someone with good mime skills. 29-year-old Anthony Daniels, who hated science fiction and had walked out of a viewing of 2001 A Space Odyssey, very nearly didn't try out for the part. He eventually met with Lucas and liked him, but remained skeptical of accepting the role until he spotted Macquarie's painting of 3PO and R2 and locked eyes with the golden droid. He seemed to be saying, "Come, come be with me," and the vulnerability in his face made me want to help him, said Daniels. "Isn't that weird?" 3 decades later, after playing the droid in 6 films, Daniels yelled at Macquarie in mock agitation, "You realize this is all your fault." Pre-production in London was moving along. Dykstra and the wizards at ILM were starting to work on the special effects, though mostly they were still building the cameras and other equipment needed to film them first, and Lucas had very nearly decided on his final cast. But there was one thing missing, something critical. He still didn't have the official green light for the project from Fox. That meant there was no budget yet, so he couldn't complete his sets, build the robots, or even design and assemble costumes and wardrobe. It had been more than 2 years since the agreement memo with Fox, and Lucas hadn't seen another dime beyond the $10,000 he'd been paid for the first draft of the script. "I had written 4 scripts, and they had only paid me for one," groused Lucas. "The least they could have done in that time was crank out 1 contract. Until that happened, he and Kurtz were continuing to lay out their own money to cover expenses, funneling most of it through the Star Wars Corporation. They would eventually spend nearly $1 million between them. Friends were worried Lucas might lose everything on his Flash Gordon thing, but Marcia remained supportive. "George takes enormous risks. He's very determined," she said. "He invested that money because he knew he was going to make that movie. He knows what he wants, and he knows how to get it. He's gambling, but he's gambling on himself and his own ability to come through." Still, costs were beginning to reach a level where even American Graffiti money couldn't keep paying for everything much longer. Lucas needed an official go from the studio, with the contract and budget that went with it, and he needed it now. Work at ILM alone was running about $25,000 per week. In the first 3 months alone, the company had soaked up more than $241,000 in costs. "I had to build my own studio, render the storyboards, devise the opticals, and I poured a lot of my own money into it," Lucas noted, adding, "I hate to waste money. I don't spend it lightly." Neither did Fox. And in October, the studio was suddenly spooked into a paralysis that very nearly cost them Star Wars altogether. It was actually Lucky Lady, the Hike Pen project filming in Mexico, that had given Fox cold feet. The film's director, Stanley Donen, was much like Lucas, independent and visionary, with a penchant for doing everything himself. But halfway through the film's production, he got into serious trouble, recalled Kurtz. The studio had to keep flying down there, and they eventually took over the entire production. That experience had so startled Fox executives that they were determined not to be caught flat-footed again by another free-spending independent director. To keep Lucas in check, Fox halted production on Star Wars, pending further review by the board of directors at its meeting scheduled for December. Until then, Lucas was effectively shut down for 2 months. Angry with Fox for waffling in its support, Lucas was determined to take the project elsewhere, even bringing the script back to United Artists and to Ned Tannen at Universal to see if either might reconsider picking up Star Wars. Both decided to give it a look. Lucas was too hot a commodity to ignore. But neither was convinced that Lucas could pull off his ambitious script, especially one that relied so heavily on special effects. Universal was particularly brusque in its brush-off, passing around a memo that dismissed both the story and Lucas's vision. "The question in the end," wrote one executive in an internal document, "is how much faith we have in Mr. Lucas's ability to pull it all off." The answer, apparently, was none. For the rest of his life, Lucas would remember Universal's slight, and he'd never let Ned Tannen forget it. He would later take considerable glee in knowing that Universal's lack of faith in him had cost the studio a $1 billion franchise. "I hold grudges," he told Rolling Stone in 1980. "Universal tried to be nice to me, but I was really angry, and I remain angry to this day." In the end, then, he was going to have to keep dealing with Fox, so he and Kurtz finally began putting together their own highly detailed budget, cutting costs and corners wherever they could to get the final number as low as possible. Working with set designer Roger Christian, they scrubbed the script for places where costs could be minimized by eliminating characters, changing the location of certain scenes to reduce the number of required sets, consolidating scenes, or eliminating some sequences altogether. In several instances, such decisions actually improved the script, as Lucas chose to remove Cloud City from the script and imprison Leia instead on the Death Star, making her rescue that much more dangerous and exciting. Lucas and artist Joe Johnson also carefully storyboarded out nearly every shot, trying to determine exactly how many scenes, sets, and special effects would be needed. Lucas was confident he had cut the fat out of the script, but feared that they were now cutting bone and sinew, a concern shared by Dykstra, who called the studio's notorious cheapness bullshit. Even with production at a standstill, Lucas was a man in constant motion, jetting between London, where he was still consulting with Barry on sets and robots, and Los Angeles, where he would hunker down with the crew at ILM. Here he would scribble on drawings, move storyboards around, and tweak models even as they were being built. And to his dismay, he'd run into a major problem with one very important spaceship. In September 1975, the Lew Grade-produced science fiction series Space 1999 had debuted on American television. Lucas watched it, and hadn't gotten much further than the opening credits when he realized that the show's central ships, the Eagle Transporters, looked a little too much like Han Solo's still unnamed pirate ship, which the ILM crew had only just constructed and rigged out with lighting. Lucas didn't want there to be even a whiff of an accusation that he had lifted his ship design from Space 1999, so he insisted the ILM team start over. Lucas told the crew he wanted something like a flying saucer, but also something with a lot more personality. Essentially, a flying hot rod that looked like it was built for speed from junked parts of other ships. So Lucas, Dykstra, and Johnson came up with a design for a ship they called the Pork Burger. Essentially, two inverted saucers with mandibles in the front and the cockpit off to one side. It wasn't until March 1976, only weeks before filming was to begin, that Lucas would hit on the ship's name. The Pork Burger would become known as the Millennium Falcon. The Fox Board of Directors held its winter meeting on Saturday, December 13, 1975. Fortunately for Lucas, Ladd did most of the talking. "I'm a believer in this," he told a skeptical and mostly quiet board listening to their Star Wars pitch, including Princess Grace of Monaco, who'd been appointed to the board over the summer. With Ladd pushing hard, giving each board member not just the scene but reams of concept art by Macquarie and Joe Johnston, the board gave its consent to greenlight the project with a budget of $8.3 million and hinted very strongly that it expected the final budget Lucas proposed to come in under that. After a great deal of negotiating on the part of Kurtz, the final projected budget was set at a very precise $8,228,228. Lucas groused that Fox was asking him to make a $15 million movie on half the budget. Nevertheless, with the project officially a go, Lucas, through the Star Wars Corporation, could finally get down to negotiating an official contract with Fox. Lucas had rightly grumbled about Fox's foot dragging for 2 years, but the delay had actually worked in his favor. With both his reputation and finances enhanced by American Graffiti, "George didn't need the money anymore," said attorney Tom Pollock. "So we went after all the things we wanted in the beginning, which is control. Control over the making of the picture and control over the exploitation of all the ancillary rights." Additionally, Lucas would own, control, about 40% of the gross profits from the film. But what he really was after was buried in the details. As a result, the 9-page deal memo ballooned to a 40-page production and distribution contract, according to which Lucas would own the rights to sequels, television, publishing, and merchandising. Areas that were important to George, said agent Jeff Berg, because he knew the life of Star Wars would exist beyond making the first theatrical motion picture. It took until nearly February 1976, about 2 weeks before cameras were to begin rolling, for the contract to be signed, and Pollock, who had seen his share of hardball tactics, thought the final document was one of the most brilliantly written movie contracts I have ever read. Not from the standpoint of the studio, but of a filmmaker getting what they want. What Lucas really wanted now was to get started. By the end of 1975, he had been struggling with Star Wars for nearly 3 years, suffering through rejection at the hands of two studios, dealing with skepticism from his friends, a depletion of his savings, and an almost lethal lack of faith from 20th Century Fox. Now he was close to finalizing his contract and his budget, his cast was falling into place, locations were being scouted, and his sound stages in London were reserved for March. Meanwhile, the crew at ILM were building cameras and storyboarding effects shots in California. John Barry and Roger Christian were working on sets in London, and Ben Burtt was collecting sound effects just about anywhere. Things looked to be on track to begin filming in March 1976, except for one thing: the always troublesome script. "This film has been murder," Lucas complained in December 1975. Compared with this, writing American Graffiti had been a cakewalk. It's very hard to write about something you make up from scratch. And the problem was, there was so much I could include. It was like being in a candy store, and it was hard not to get a stomachache from the whole experience. As 1976 approached, Lucas was finishing up his fourth draft, now officially titled The Adventures of Luke Starkiller, as taken from the Journal of the Whills, Saga 1, Star Wars. Lucas was still paring down subplots and characters, removing elements that either slowed things down or required too much backstory. He had a much better handle on the Force at this point, and had wisely decided to remove the Kyber crystal from the story altogether, making the Force more ethereal, he explained, rather than to have it solidified in a thing like a crystal. The Force was a big idea, he told science fiction writer Alan Dean Foster, whom he had personally tapped to write a novelization of the film. Luke has to trust his feelings rather than his senses and his logic. That's essentially what The Force of Others comes down to. There is no indication that Lucas ever intended for Darth Vader to be Anakin Skywalker, or that he would be the father of Luke and Leia, twins separated at birth. While Lucas would, over the course of three decades, perpetuate a kind of retroactive continuity by asserting that this had been his plan all along, in 1975, he still clearly intended for Vader and Luke's father to be separate characters. Vader's backstory, he explained, was about Ben and Luke's father and Vader, when they are young Jedi Knights. Vader kills Luke's father, then Ben and Vader have a confrontation, just like they have in Star Wars, and Ben almost kills Vader. As for the name Vader, Lucas has made much of the linguistic coincidence that Vader is the Dutch word for father, but it was also a name he'd likely heard nearly daily at Downey High School, where he had a schoolmate one grade ahead, an all-conference athlete named Gary Vader. For Lucas, who loved the way words sounded, it was too good a last name not to use. By the time Lucas completed his fourth draft on January 1st, 1976, he had come a long way since the non-starter Journal of the Whills, but he was still unhappy with it. "I had a lot of vague concepts," he remembered years later, "but I didn't really know where to go with it, and I've never fully resolved it. It's very hard stumbling across the desert, picking up rocks, not knowing what I'm looking for, and knowing the rock I've got is not the rock I'm looking for. I kept simplifying it, and I kept having people read it, and I kept trying to get a more cohesive story, but I'm still not very happy with the script. I never have been." "In the end," Lucas said later, "I really didn't think we were going to make any money at all on Star Wars."